Good evening. It is great to finally get to be here. I appreciate you all inviting us. We've been looking forward to this meeting for quite a while. I know it got postponed for quite a while, and we're happy that it finally got to happen. It's kind of weird coming here where many of you know my family. I feel like you all know me more than I know you, but hopefully by the end of this weekend, some of that will change, and I'll get to know you all a little bit better as well. We're looking forward to the weekend. I think it's going to be good. When I suggested the topics, I gave a few different options, and the option that I think you all settled on was this topic of Jesus and the towel, the idea of love and service and how we can be serving each other. And one of the reasons I suggested that topic is because I think just among churches in general, that's always a needed topic, to learn how we can love and serve each other better. But what I didn't know was, I suggested that back before this whole pandemic broke out. And really, I think if there was ever a time when this topic was needed in churches, it is now. Now that we've got all the challenges of being separated from each other, and where there are all these needs that, much more so than before, I think there's so much more need for a topic like this. But on top of that, you have the challenge that it's so much more difficult to practice that. Before, it was much easier to get together and to show our love and encouragement to each other. Now there's a mountain of challenges in that kind of regard. So I think this topic is going to be very much needed and hopefully very helpful as well. And so what I wanted to do tonight is start out with a lesson that's very much related to the other lessons we're going to be doing, but hit on it from a direction that I think is maybe even more accessible to the pandemic right now. A lot of times, we know we need to be serving each other. We want to show love to each other, but there are too many obstacles in the way. There are just a lot of challenges that make that hard. And so tonight's lesson is titled Power in Weakness. It's going to be about how we can serve each other even in our weaknesses. How a lot of times we use our weaknesses as a hindrance. Tonight, I want to look at how we can use our weaknesses actually as an advantage, as something that's actually going to help us serve better. And this lesson was originally part of a series of several lessons, but I kind of merged them a little bit just to try to put it all together for you tonight. This comes from 1 and 2 Corinthians, and it's something that's inspired me for quite a while. What I've noticed is in 1 and 2 Corinthians, Paul builds this theme of power and weakness from Jesus' cross. And it's one of those things where you don't notice it at first, but then you'll get to a verse and you'll start thinking about it, and then you start to see it everywhere. And that's how it was for me when I discovered this theme in there. So start with me at the beginning of 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And let's look at the way that Paul treats this concept of power and weakness from Jesus' cross. Now you think about the Corinthians who he's writing to. Corinth was this city that was a wealthy city, had a lot of commerce, had a lot of entertainment. It was this city that was very well-to-do. Typically, in a worldly city like that, you value power. The people who get things are the people who are powerful. The people who make powerful things happen are the powerful people. And so in a society like that, it's especially hard to understand this concept of weakness is actually what God values. And so look with me at how Paul describes this. Here's 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21. Here's what Paul says. For since, in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Okay, here's what he says we preach. Oh, let me get this on here. There we go. All right, so tonight we're going to be talking about overcoming these challenging circumstances, how we have all these weaknesses and challenges, how are we going to overcome that and use those to our advantage. So here's the way Paul summarizes the gospel to these people. We preached Christ crucified. And I appreciate the songs that we just had and how well that related to this about Christ's crucifixion. That's what he preached. He said that's what he came there to talk about was Jesus being crucified. And that's what he focused on. That was it. That was it, the message. Then he talks about the challenge of this. Well, for the people there, that seemed weird. That seemed strange. Why are we talking about a crucified man? And he talks about this contrast, this weakness and power. He says the weakness of God, how did he say it here? Verse 24, but those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So you have, he says, even the weakest thing that God does is stronger than anything that we do. And he's showing here, they're looking for power, and God didn't bring them that. He brought them something very strange. He brought them something extremely weak. All right, jump with me to chapter 2. Look how he does this in chapter 2, verse 1. And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, but I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest on the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Okay, he says, I was with you in weakness, there in verse 3. I came to you in weakness. That's not the way you expected. But then he turns around and says, but I was there in the demonstration of the power of the Spirit. And then he says in verse 5, so that your faith may not rest on the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. That's what I wanted your faith to be in. Okay, so this apparently was a challenging thing for the Corinthians. He was trying to help them see this concept of the gospel message is not what human beings would mostly be looking for, that we would be looking for something very powerful, Christ swooping in with a big army and conquering everything or something like that. Instead, the victory of the cross is a cross. It's a man suffering and hanging there and bleeding and dying. It's the weakest possible state of any human being. And yet, it brings about the most powerful event in all history. And Paul's trying to get them that across to them. So throughout, you have that message in 1 Corinthians where he's trying to say, this is what the gospel message is like. It's about Christ's weakness, but it's his power through that. Now, follow me over to 2 Corinthians. Go over to chapter 4, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And once you get to 2 Corinthians, Paul starts bringing application of this concept to himself. And he starts talking about how this convergence of Christ's weakness and Christ's power is lived out in a Christian. So look with me at this, chapter 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. All right, I like this picture. Carrying something in a little jar, made out of clay. Carrying treasure, this priceless treasure, but it's in this ugly-looking jar. It's not in a treasure chest. It's in this ugly jar. And he's saying, Paul's that jar. He's this piece of clay, but he's got the treasure inside. Well, what's the benefit to that? Why do you put the treasure in a clay jar? Well, it's so that you don't notice the jar. All you notice is the treasure inside. And he says, in this method of carrying the gospel, what you see is the surpassing power belongs to God and not to Paul. That was the idea. All right, he continues here. Verse 8, we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed. He sets up this contrast
of we are this, but we are not this. We are this, but we are not that. He's going to develop this that some more in a little bit. Verse 10, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our bodies. All right, here's what I want to show. All right, so here's this power and weakness thing. The world spends a lot of time on the world. They notice the weakness. They see that. They see that. And but God, He demonstrates this power. All right, here's the way this is going to work. We're talking about Christ's death and Christ's life. Both of those are manifest in Paul. Here's what he says here. Verse 10, always carrying the body, the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our bodies. Both Christ's life and his death are manifest in Paul. He says, in his body. Both of those he's demonstrating simultaneously. In order for Paul to live out the life of Christ, he's also got to live out the death of Christ. And that's why he has this weird convergence of things happening here. Just like at the cross, you had this weird convergence of the absolute weakest moment of mankind with the absolute most powerful moment of God, converging at that scene, at that moment. Paul is saying, that's basically being lived out in my life. That's why I've got these things where I'm being persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed. There's this weird mix constantly happening in Paul. And where the world may see just the weakness of the persecution, God sees this other thing. God sees the power that's at work here. Paul sees that power that's at work. All right, then here's what he says in verse 11. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. So Paul's saying, the more I die, the more I suffer in this state, it shows Jesus' life more and more. And it shows it in you. He's saying, my death results in your life. And he's really making himself a model of Jesus. That's exactly what Jesus did. Jesus' death resulted in our life. Paul's saying, I live out the same thing every day as well. And he's trying to hold himself up as a model of that's what Christians need to be. We need to live out the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus will be lived out in others as well. All right, there is so much to think about, just even in that one paragraph. Thinking through this concept of both Jesus' death and his life are manifest in us as Christians simultaneously. All right, let's continue to follow this through 2 Corinthians. Turn over to chapter 6. Here's the way Paul shows this over in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And here he says, in verse 3, he starts to build this contrast here. This contrast between his circumstances and his response to his circumstances. So here's what he says, verse 3. We put no obstacle in anyone's way, so that no fault may be found with our ministry. But as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, by great endurance, in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights, hunger. Wow, that's a lot of stuff. So here he's got affliction, hardship, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights, hunger. And you read the book of Acts, and you definitely see all that. I mean, that really describes Paul's life. I mean, there's a lot of suffering. I mean, most of us, maybe some of us have gone through maybe one or two of those. I doubt that many of us could check off very many things on that list. Paul went through all those. Then, here's what he contrasts that with. He says verse 6, by purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, the Holy Spirit, genuine love, by truthful speech and the power of God, with weapons of righteousness for the right hand and for the left. Through honor and dishonor, through slander and praise, we are treated as imposters and yet are true. And he goes on. Here's what I want to show, though. Here's the contrast. He contrasts this first list with a second list. Purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, the Holy Spirit, genuine love, truthful speech, power of God, weapons of righteousness. Now, you look at those two things. None of those go together. I mean, on one side, it looks like he lost. I mean, it looks like everything went wrong. I mean, everything was a failure. On the other side, it's the perfect model of a Christian. And he rams them up side by side. He's saying that they actually, they fit together perfectly. He said that's the perfect match. Now, for us, I think a lot of times those two things are in opposition. I think, you know, I'm usually a really patient person. Except when a calamity happens, then I'm not such a patient person. When I'm going through a hard time, you know, I'd normally be pretty patient, but in times of hardship, that's when my patience is tried and I'm not that patient of a person. Or, you know, I'm really a kind person, but when someone's been mean to me, let's underline the beating one or something, when someone's been unkind to me, that's when it's really hard to be kind. In every one of those, the excuse we make for the ones on the not practicing the ones on the right is usually because we're going through the one on the left. You think about the, I'm usually typically a really loving person, but you know, when I'm hungry, I'm not that loving sometimes. You know, I'm usually really patient and kind and loving and all that, but after, if I don't get a good night's sleep, well, you can understand me not being that kind if I don't get a good night's sleep. And yet Paul joins them together and says, one leads to the other. These two things, this is how the Christian life matches up with this weakness and this power. Well, how does that work, Paul? How do we put those together? And that's the big question. How do those two things, do two lists match up at all? Maybe some of it has to do with the bottom of the list. When we get to things like the power of God, or when we get weapons of righteousness, that it's not weapons of this world, that it's weapons of spiritual weapons, that maybe the power that Paul's drawing from is something much more spiritual here. All right, so a lot of different things to think about. Let's bring this all together at the end. Well, let's fast forward to the end of 2 Corinthians first. Fast forward to the end of 2 Corinthians, and look with me at the verse that just really culminates this. Chapter 12, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Here's what he says. Verse 9. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weakness, insults, hardships, persecution, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Here's the way Paul just brings this topic all together at the end of the book. This is after he talks about his thorn in the flesh and him praying for it to go away, and God said no. And then God explains and says, well, the reason I'm not going to take away the thorn is because my power is made perfect in weakness. And then Paul says, got it. I understand. Now I get it. Now he says, now, for the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weakness. Because when I am weak, then I am strong. He says, when I am weak, then I am strong. Christ's power is seen through this weakness. The weaker Paul gets, the more of Christ's strength is shown through Paul. Okay, so great things to think about. I mean, just there's so much we can just sit there and think about with this concept of how does that play out in our lives. What I want to do now is, now that we've seen this played out in Paul's life, I want to turn to us and really talk about, practically, how can we live this? What can we do? How do we live out this concept of power when we feel like we just can't do it? When I hit that point where I would do a lot more for Christ, but my circumstances just don't allow it right now. How do I tap into this concept that Paul has of weakness is actually an advantage for Christ instead of a disadvantage? And what I want to do is I want us to turn over to 2 Corinthians, towards the middle of the book, 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And in chapter 8, Paul seems to completely switch gears. If you've read through 2 Corinthians very much, you know that this almost feels out of place in 2 Corinthians. That he goes through and he talks a lot about himself in the beginning chapters. And then in the last chapters, he talks a lot about himself. He defends his apostleship quite a bit. But here in the middle, you get chapter 8 and chapter 9, and they seem to come out of nowhere. There, suddenly he's talking about this gift that they're giving to help the needy Christians, and there was nothing about that earlier, it didn't seem like. It just suddenly, all right, let's talk about this gift, spends two chapters talking about it, and then right back to where he was before, and he's talking about his apostleship again. And you're thinking, well, why did we get the pages shuffled around? Why is this one here? And why not put it as like kind of an addendum at the end or something? Why is that right smack in the very middle of the book? What it seems like Paul does is, after spending so much time before and after talking about this concept of power and weakness in himself, when you get to chapter 8, he applies it all to his readers. And he uses the same concept to motivate them to be generous with their gifts in this giving to the needy saints. And so I want us to focus the rest of the lesson on the application from chapters 8 and 9. And you'll see it goes way beyond financial giving. I mean, really, these applications go for any kind of service towards other people and really any kind of service towards God. Here's the challenge we face. You all can probably relate to this. Here are my circumstances. In general, I can grow as high as my circumstances allow. If I were in different circumstances, I could do better. But given my circumstances, that's the height I can get to. And you can fill in the blank with what those circumstances are. You can think about, well, I would be doing a lot more for Christ if it weren't for my work schedule. But given my work schedule, I can get that high. Or I would be doing a lot more for Christ, but given my family situation, there's a lot of limitations there, you might say, with the family situation. Given that, that's the limit. Or I would be doing a lot more, but given my health situation, that's the limit. I would be doing a lot more, but given my skill set, that's the limit. And so many other things that we can fill in there where we create this line. And we may not say it to ourselves, we may not say it to anyone else, but we may think in those kinds of terms, that I'm doing the best I can given the circumstances. That's kind of the way we can argue it with ourselves. Now, here's the challenge. Once I hit that invisible ceiling and I somehow tell myself this is the best I can do for right now, as I think you all know, what happens to a Christian when we quit growing is that. And we may think, well, I can't grow anymore. I hit the limit. But we all know the concept that when a Christian quits growing, a Christian starts dying. And that makes this a really relevant topic. That if there are these circumstances that have created an artificial ceiling for me, and if I've told myself that's the best I can do because of these weaknesses, then it's very likely I'm going to start to shrink up. So in this chapter, we're going to figure out how to do better than that. All right, let's talk about overcoming our circumstances. Start with me in chapter 8, verse 1. We want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. Okay, the first point, and we're going to divide this into a few different points, a few different strategies we can use for overcoming these weaknesses. The first one I want us to see is this concept of joy. Here he points them towards the Macedonians, and he says, I want you to think about what these guys did. And I want you to see how their joy made the difference in their circumstances. So here's how it plays out. He says, in a severe test of affliction, I mean, things were not going well for the Macedonians, coupled with an abundance of joy. Again, those don't seem to go together. Coupled with extreme poverty. You put those three things together. All right, let's add up severe affliction, abundance of joy, extreme poverty. What do you get when you add those all up together? Here's what Paul gets: an overflow of wealth of generosity.
Now, if you look, think of those as an equation, it doesn't seem to balance. I mean, we've got poverty on one side, extreme poverty on one side, and we've got a wealth of generosity on the other side. So here we've got poverty on one end and wealth on the other. How does that go together? How do these people who are extremely poor become extremely wealthy, have an overflowing of wealth? And the key, of course, is joy. If you just take affliction and you put it with poverty, you might not get generosity. But here's the key, was this joy. They loved to serve. It made them just so ecstatic to be able to serve. And so it didn't matter if they didn't have much, what they were going to do, because they loved it, because they were so excited to do it, they were going to use what they had and they were going to be generous. And to the point that it was overflowing of generosity, because it was overflowing with joy. It was an abundance of joy, which led to this just abundance of gifts and generosity. Now, here's what I see as the application of that. We do what we enjoy. Now, there's a lot of things we do that we don't enjoy, but it's hard to do things you don't enjoy. And I might be able to do things I don't enjoy for a while, but eventually you get to a point where if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to be doing it very much. But there are certain things that you really enjoy that even when it's hard to do it, it's easy to find time for it because it's something you really enjoy. And a lot of times, and I think you all can probably relate to this, if when it comes to being a Christian, if you take joy in doing a certain thing for Christ, you'll do it a whole lot more than if it's just kind of a duty and we just kind of need to do it. And so the first key really here is for finding joy in the things we do for Christ. That if I can look at it, and if there's something that I'm struggling to do because my circumstances just don't allow it very much, if when I do it, I take a lot of joy in it, I'll probably find that I start doing it even more than I thought I could before, because I love it that much. So number one is joy. Next one, next way to overcome our circumstances is by taking the initiative. Look at how the Macedonians do in this respect. Verse 3, "For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints." Okay, they gave according to their means. They gave beyond their means. They just kept giving and giving and giving. And then here's this big phrase, begging to take part in it. They really wanted to be a part of this. It wasn't that Paul had to beg them. I mean, this is their money. Their money they're handing over to Paul. And Paul's not begging them. They're begging Paul to take their money. "Here, take this. Paul, would you please take this?" And Paul's saying, "No, I don't really think I should take. Please, please, I want to give this. Are you sure about that? How are you guys going to live if you give us all that? We want to, Paul, we're going to do this." That's the kind of attitude they had. Now, a great way to check ourselves in this kind of respect is to think about, how many things do I do for Christ on my own initiative? I choose to do it. And how many times have I done it because someone asked me to, or reminded me to, or encouraged me to? If I'm the kind of person that I'll do things when somebody says, hey, God, could you please do this over here? We really need someone to help over here. If I'm the kind of person who mostly does that, then I'm probably going to be also the kind of person who's very limited by my circumstances. Hey, we really need someone to help with this. Well, I would, but I just don't have a lot of time right now. But instead, if I'm the kind of person who's looking around and saying, all right, what needs to be done? What could I do? There's something I could do. That's something that needs to be done. Somebody needs to do it. Why don't I do it? I don't have a lot of time. Well, I'll make some time because it needs to get done. That's the way these people served. All right, those are the first two things. Let's look at the third one, giving themselves. Here's the way this one is played out. Verse 5, "And this, not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then by the will of God, to us." All right, here's That's not good. All right, let's get these back up. All right. This is a lot worse. I don't know if you've watched the videos, but we're preaching outdoors now. So if you can imagine me with all the papers outside when it's windy and how that goes. So this is actually quite a bit better. All right. So where were we? Okay. So here we are with, in the situation, if I'm going to give my stuff to you, and I realize there's a need, and I need to help you all out, and then I think, well, how much am I going to help you out? I mean, I've got to leave some for me. I mean, this person needs something, but I don't have a lot of time, or I don't have a lot of money, and so I've got to make that decision. And so I've got, let's see, that many green dots, and I'm thinking, how many of those green dots can I share with you? So I'll give you 2. That seems about right. I mean, if I gave you more, I'd start to run out. And so if I'm thinking in those kinds of terms, it's very much about, well, how many should I keep for me? That's one way to do it. And I could give that way, and you could give that way, and we'd help each other out, and we'd serve God that way. But that's a very limited approach compared to what these Macedonians did. Here's the much better approach. There's a middle step that's left out when we do it the way we just looked at. The middle step is God. What the Macedonians did was first, they gave everything to God, gave themselves completely to God. That was the first step. And then once they'd done that, the second step was so much easier. With the second step, all right, now, how much should I give to you? Well, I've already given it all to God. So it's not a matter of, well, how much should I keep for me? Now, I mean, it's much easier. I can say, well, then I think the need would need about this much. And I think that's how much God would give if he were giving. Much easier. Because now selfishness is removed from the equation. If I've already made the decision that everything belongs to God and nothing belongs to me, then all of this is so much simpler. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this in one of the later lessons, getting into this idea of our stewardship and how do we take care of the things that God's entrusted to us. So with this one, just really thinking through, how do I think of things as my own and make decisions about, well, I really need it for me, or do I think in terms of it already all belongs to God, now how much would God give to this person? It makes a huge difference. Okay, so those are our obstacles. Let's look at 2 other obstacles as we kind of wrap things up here. 2 other obstacles that I think come into play quite a bit on this. One is commands. And this may seem weird. I mean, how does a command here get in the way of this? It seems odd because, I mean, the Bible's full of commands. Commands should motivate us. But look at what Paul says here in verse 8. I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine. Paul actually says, guys, I'm not commanding you to do this. Well, Paul, you're an apostle. You're writing the scriptures here. Don't you think you could just say, thou shalt give to these other Christians? I mean, that would make sense. And Paul says, actually, this time I'm not going to do it that way. Now, why not? What would be the issue with giving a command? I mean, Paul could have said, all right, everybody in the church in Corinth is going to give 10% every Sunday, and then when I get there, we should have about the right amount. He could have done that. And he deliberately says, I didn't do that. He could have said 20%, 50%. I'm going to raise the level as high as he needed to. What would have happened if he had done that? If he had said, all right, just it's a rule, everybody gives 10%. Or we could say everybody gives $20. However, we're going to divide that. What would happen? Well, my guess is most everybody, if they've got a good heart, would give their $20, give their 10%, give whatever it was the command was. And they'd hit right on the line. Now, what's wrong with that? Here's what Paul said he did instead. Instead, he says, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine. To prove by the earnestness of others that your love is genuine. Instead of giving a command that kind of gives you this level of where you need to be at, he says, hey,
look over there. Look at the Macedonians. Look what they did. You just learn something from that. All right, and then after you've learned something, go make your own decision. Now, if we take that approach, what's going to happen? Instead of me saying, all right, I got the command, I did it, check it off. Instead, it's going to be this motivation that there's no ceiling anymore. I can just keep growing and growing and growing as long as I've got an example that keeps stretching higher. And in fact, he gives us an example that stretches much higher than the Macedonians. Here's what he says in verse 9. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich. So he says, you know the grace of Jesus. And he holds out this example of Jesus. And we've seen this is what he does to Corinthians. He tries to show us how Jesus' example is what we're living out, this power and weakness. All right, so he says, here's what Jesus did. He was rich, and yet for your sake, he became poor, so that by his poverty, you might become rich. And we can think of what that means on the cross, of him giving up all of heaven to come down here to this earth and suffering and dying so that we could have all of heaven. I mean, you can see how that all plays out, but he's putting these terms of rich and poor and everything so that they can apply it to this financial situation. And so he's saying, look, there's Christ. That's what Christ did. He gave up everything for you. Now, you just go home, meditate on that, and then you think of how much you need to give. Wow. Well, at that point, I guess I'm probably not giving enough. I mean, at that point, what it does is it motivates us way beyond those artificial ceilings we may have imposed through a command or through a circumstance. All right, here's the other one. Here's another obstacle. What about weariness? And this is where I've been working hard, and I've been doing really well. I mean, I've been giving way beyond what you'd think you could during those circumstances. And we've just been pushing and pushing and pushing. And after a while, you can only do that for so long before you kind of start to get worn out. And I mean, you can only push so much, and your circumstances, when they're limiting, it wears you out. What do we do in that situation? Here's the way Paul deals with it in verse 10. And in this matter, I give my judgment. This befits you, who a year ago started not only to do this work, but also to desire to do it. So now finish doing it as well, so that your readiness in desiring it may be matched by your completing it out of what you have. He says, I know you started really well, but my fear is you're not going to finish well. You've been doing it, you've been pushing, you've been pushing, you've been pushing, and now I kind of feel like you're not pushing anymore. And something happened. After a while, you just got tired and you got distracted and it's not happening anymore. That's what he's saying to the Corinthians. What is he going to do about that? Look in the next chapter, chapter 9, verse 3. Here's what he says. But I am sending the brothers so that our boasting about you may not prove empty in this matter, so that you may be ready, as I said you would be. Otherwise, if some Macedonians come with me, and I find that you are not ready, we would be humiliated, to say nothing of you, for being so confident. So here's what Paul does. He's already told them, look at other people's examples. Go look at the Macedonians. Look at what they're doing. That will motivate you, even through those hard times. But then here's what further he does. He says, now, think about the other person who's looking at your example. What happens when some other people show up and they're expecting you to have given a lot and you just kind of haven't? How's that going to affect them? How's that going to let them down? How is that going to affect their growth? And so one of the things that I think is really motivating when we get tired and maybe we're not doing as much for Christ is to think about the other people who are watching us. Maybe it's younger people, maybe it's our kids, maybe it's other people in the church, maybe it's people in the world. And thinking about they're watching us and they're seeing what we do. And if I quit or I get weak or I'm just not doing that much, what is that going to do for them? But if they see me pushing through and growing higher and doing more, how is that going to motivate them? And that's what Paul wants these Corinthians to think about. Okay, let's put it together with one final point. We have had a lot of different things to think about. I mean, this is all based on this concept of Christ's power seen through his weakness. and that he wants us to demonstrate his power through our weakness. And we've seen all these different ways to do that and strategies to try to work towards that better. But one final thing to ask is, what's my goal? When I'm struggling with this and I'm trying to do better, one of the best things I can do is just ask, all right, why am I doing this? And here's what Paul says. Turn with me to back to chapter 8, verse 19. And not only that, but he has been appointed by the churches to travel with us as we carry out this act of grace that is being ministered by us for the glory of the Lord himself and to show our good will. It says, the goal of this gift, I mean, yes, it helps some Christians who are in need, who really need it right now. Yes, that's a really good, noble goal. But the ultimate goal goes so much beyond just some people who are kind of who are starving right now. It goes way beyond that. If there were more to go beyond that, it goes way beyond that. It goes to God's glory. That's the ultimate purpose. Now, when that's the purpose, here's what that does. When you're in those weak circumstances, and the best you can do is only a little bit, but you push hard and you do that little bit, what that does is other people see that, and they see you doing that in your weakness, and it actually gives more glory to God than the person who does a whole lot, and it's just kind of out of their surplus. I mean, it's very much the widow's mite kind of thing. It's the lady who put in all that she had, and it meant more than all the people who put in out of their abundance. It's very much like, you've probably seen this, and this seems to be the case in just about any church, where you've got the people who can come all the time to every single service, and they're well and healthy, and they're always there. And then you've got that one older lady who comes in on a Sunday morning on her walker, and she sits the very back, and she comes in real slowly, and she sits down, and she can only be there that one service, and yet she's got this joy that just lights up the whole entire room. And that one act of her coming there that day means more than all the numbers of people coming the other times, because you can see that she's hurting and it's hard, and she's there, and you see that she wants to be there, and there's no place else in the world that she'd rather be. And that's an example of this, someone who's using their weakness in a way that glorifies God. Let's close with this verse. Look with me at 2 Corinthians. Here it's on the screen. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. That's the point. I'm just a jar of clay. And it's good that I'm just a jar of clay, because when I'm just a jar of clay with all the bumps and weaknesses and cracks and problems, it shows the treasure so much brighter. Let's use those weaknesses in a way that brings even more glory to Christ. Let's find ways to glorify God. If you're not a Christian, then what we want to do is we want to invite you to come forward tonight and to choose that you'll follow Christ through whatever weaknesses and whatever challenges you have. Because the fact is, Jesus came down in the weakest possible state and died for you so that the most powerful act of God could bring your life, that his death brought your life. And if you're subject to that invitation, then we invite you to come forward this evening and to be baptized while together we stand and we sing.